Now, coming closer to the subject of the Tibetan Buddhist monks, we may say that there are six grades of Tibetan monks. The first is what is called the grade of Genye. Genye corresponds to the Indian Upasaka or lay Buddhist. And in Tibetan Buddhism there are two kinds of Genye. One is simply a layman who observes the five silas, and that is to say the five moral precepts. And the other sense of the term is the probationer in a monastery who observes 10 silas. And when we speak of the Genye as the first grade, as it were, of Tibetan monk, then Genye is to be understood in the second of these two senses. In other words, as a sort of probationer living in the monastery, serving the monks and observing 10 ethical precepts. So this is the first grade, the Genye. Secondly comes the Gitsu, and this corresponds to the Indian Shramaniya. And according to the Tibetan tradition, following the Sarvastivada tradition, the Shramaniya is a novice monk, one who is studying to become a fully ordained monk, a novice monk observing 36 silas or 36 moral precepts. The ordination of a Gitsu or Shramaniya, cannot be given before the age of 7 or 8. And incidentally, I should observe that Tibetans, like most Buddhists, when they reckon your age, they don't count your years from the date of your birth. They say quite rightly, quite logically, that you begin to exist before birth. They count from conception. So whereas you would say perhaps that you were, say, 25, as the case may be, the Tibetans would say that you were 26, because they add on an extra year, or at least an extra 10 months, to cover the prenatal period. So when you apply for ordination, they expect you to give your age according to the date, the inferred date at least, the rough date of your conception, rather than the date of your birth, which would seem to be rather more logical. So this is the second degree, or second grade of ordination, or second kind of Tibetan monk, the Gitsu, or the novice monk. Now thirdly, we have the Gelong. Gelong corresponds to the Indian Bhikshu, or Pali Bhikkhu. And the Gelong is, of course, the fully ordained monk. One can't be ordained as a Gelong before one's 20th year, and very often one waits until later. You may remember that the week before last we saw that Tsongkhapa, the great founder of the Gelugpa school, waited for his higher ordination, as it's called, until he was 25. Now the Tibetan Gelong observes 150 silas, or 150 ethical precepts, divided into 7 categories. And in addition to these 150 rules proper, there are various rules of what we would regard as monastic etiquette. The first of the 7 categories of rules proper contains 4 precepts, and these are the most important. And these precepts prohibit for the fully ordained monk, first of all, marriage, secondly, theft, thirdly, taking of life deliberately, and fourthly, the making of false claims regarding one's own spiritual attainments and experiences. So this is the Gelong, the fully ordained monk. Fourthly, there's the Geshe. The Geshe is usually translated, or sometimes translated by some people at least, as Doctor of Buddhist Divinity. But I don't feel that that's quite suitable. And when I first saw it on the visiting card of an English-knowing Tibetan Geshe, I was rather astonished. He put his name and then Doctor of Buddhist Divinity, and I think in brackets Lhasa or something like that. So the Geshe is the learned monk, you may say. And for the Geshe, there are 5 chief subjects of study, to which he devotes, as we shall see, many, many years of his life. First of all, he studies Vinaya, or monastic discipline. There's a very great deal of literature, a very great deal of material under this heading, some of it rather abstruse. a few simple monastic rules in the course of centuries have grown into a vast and complex and quasi-legal system. And sometimes in the Sangha, in the monastic order, you have to have special monk lawyers, as it were, to unravel all the complexities of the monastic law so that you can know and be quite sure whether you've committed an offence or not. So in this way, it does become a little complicated. So the geshe has first of all to study the Vinaya, the monastic law. His second subject of study is the Abhidharma. I don't know whether any of you, or many of you, have encountered the Abhidharma before. This is a rather abstruse and technical division of Buddhist literature. It embraces what we would call psychological ethics. It's descriptive psychology, analytical psychology, in the sense of the analysis of mental states, analysis of them into their constituent functions and so on. And it does become very, very complex indeed. There's an enormous literature in this field, in Sanskrit, in Tibetan, in Chinese, and so on. It's, in a sense, Buddhist theology, you may say, provided you understand that there's no theos in Buddhism. So the geshe has to study the Abhidharma, and of course he studies it in the Sarvastivada version, the Tibetan translations of the Sanskrit versions of the Abhidharma. Thirdly, he studies the perfection of wisdom scriptures, the Prajnaparamita Sutras. And the perfection of wisdom scriptures are the most important group of Mahayana sutras. There are about 35 of them altogether, 35 perfection of wisdom scriptures. And luckily for us, they are all available in English now, thanks to the labours of Dr. Edward Kunze, who has translated them all. As I'm sure most of you know, the Diamond Sutra, the Vajracchedika Sutra, is particularly popular. As popular in Tibet as it is in Japan, in the Zen school, and it's recited on every possible occasion. The Tibetans call it the Dorje Chöpa, which means the Diamond Cutter Sutra. So the geshe, your Doctor of Buddhist Divinity, studies the perfection of wisdom scriptures too, all 35 of them, ideally, together with commentaries, sub-commentaries, and so on. And fourthly, he studies Madhyamika philosophy. I put philosophy in single inverted commas because it isn't quite philosophy in our sense. The Madhyamika is the teaching or the doctrine of the middle way, is a highly metaphysical, even a highly dialectical teaching. It was founded, or the tradition was founded, by Nagarjuna, a great Indian Buddhist thinker, early in the Christian era. And the Madhyamika tradition is based on the Prajnaparamita, or perfection of wisdom scriptures. And we may say that the Madhyamika is a sort of dialectical and logical version of the perfection of wisdom teaching, a more intellectualized version, if you like. Fifthly and lastly, the geshe studies logic. Indian Buddhism had a very rich tradition of logical studies, and the Gelugpas especially attach very great importance to this. Tsongkhapa himself was very much given to logical studies, and his disciples have tended to follow in his footsteps. So the geshe studies logic, Buddhist logic. And the Gelugpa studied, as I've said more, the other schools tend to be less enthusiastic about it. There are many Indian Buddhist treatises on logic by the great masters of Indian logic like Jignyagwa and Dharmakirti, and these have been translated into Tibetan, and they're very, very avidly studied by the Tibetan and Mongolian geshes. In fact, we may say that Tibet has kept up the tradition of the study of Buddhist logic more than any other part of the Buddhist world. If you look at Chinese Buddhism, you'll find no logic. They just were interested in Indian Buddhist logic. Same with Japan. They preferred a more direct and more intuitive approach. But the Tibetans, especially the Gelugpas, they thrive on logic. They love these logical distinctions. And they've worked out all sorts of theories of the syllogism and so on, very much along Aristotelian lines, and have become, perhaps, if anything, even more complex than that. Indian Buddhist logic is possibly almost as advanced as the most recent Western logic in many respects. Some scholars, of course, are of the opinion that the Indian Buddhist and Tibetan Buddhist logicians got rather far away from the spiritual teachings of the Buddha. But the Indians and the Tibetans justify themselves and say, well, it's all part of the Bodhisattva ideal. Because what is the Bodhisattva supposed to be doing? He's supposed to be converting everybody, maturing everybody spiritually, bringing them onto the path. So it isn't so easy. You've got to discuss, you've got to argue with people. So how can you argue with them unless you know logic, unless you can argue rationally? So therefore, they say, the Bodhisattva ought to study logic. Not only ought to study rhetoric, or to study poetry even. And some go so far as to say the Bodhisattva should know arts and crafts and should even be a good dancer. But you see the idea that all this is equipment, as it were, to help and to lead beings on the path to enlightenment. So therefore, the geshe, usually with great enthusiasm, studies logic as the fifth and last of these five subjects of his course. Now, even with just these five subjects, with Vinaya, or monastic discipline, with the Abhidharma, with the perfection of wisdom scriptures, with the Majjhimika philosophy, and with logic, with just these five subjects, it takes not less, usually, than 12 years to complete the Geshe's course. And sometimes it takes 20. I've met myself a number of geishas who didn't pass out until they were well on in their 40s and even their 50s. One may say that the system of study is largely tutorial. That is to say, there are no lectures to large audiences. You usually just go along and study the subject concerned, whether Vinaya or Abhidharma or Majjhimika, perfection of wisdom or logic, with your own teacher, your own tutor, either just by yourself individually or with just two or three others. So it's either individual tuition or very, very small classes. And examinations are held yearly. Every year there's an examination. And you'll be interested to hear that the examinations are entirely oral. There's no written work at all. What happens is this. On the day of the examination, you, the individual candidate, all by yourself, you come into the examination hall. And sitting around, all around you, there are hundreds of geishes. Those who have already passed out, that is, passed the geishes course, in a vast hall, and they're sitting all around, in a great circle. And you are in the middle, just sitting there, just all by yourself, no other candidate with you. And then what do? They fire at you questions, one after the other, on any of these five subjects. And the question may come from any part of the hall. So what will happen is, and I've had this described to me by people who've been through it, you'll just be sitting there sort of quaking and waiting for the first question, and from the right will come a very technical question about Vinaya. You have to give the answer just like that. And you've just given your answer, then behind you comes a question about logic. A very technical question. You have to give your answer to that. And then, before you've recovered from that, a question on the perfection of wisdom. And it gets more and more abstruse, and they're trying to catch you out the whole time. And this goes on, this grueling sort of examination, goes on for several hours together. Questions are fired, as I say, from all sides. And even the Dalai Lama has to go through this. And some of my friends who were present gave me a description of the Dalai Lama's examination. And they said that the Dalai Lama, at one crucial moment, was almost caught napping. Almost. The questions are so tough that though he'd been trained and taught very, very well, I forget whether it was logic or Vinaya or what it was, but one question, just for one terrible instant, it seemed as though he wasn't going to be able to answer it. And then someone told me he sort of suddenly recovered himself, and he came up with the answer with a terrific sort of roar, and everybody was very, very pleased that he'd given, because after all he was a Dalai Lama, very pleased that he'd given the right answer. But there are four grades of pass. You have first class, second class, third class, fourth class. The Dalai Lama was given a second class pass, which shows that the system is very, very fair and objective. A first class is almost unheard of. I believe there are only two or three geishas alive at present who've passed in the first division, as it were. You very, very rarely get more than a second. Now, I should also mention that this whole sort of process, this whole process of oral examination, this viva voce examination, is strictly stylized. When you ask the question and when you answer, there are certain sort of ritual gestures you have to assume. There's a certain way of asking. I've seen it all done, but I can't quite recall it or reproduce it. But very roughly, sometimes it happens when you put your question, you have to thrust out your forefinger like this, and fix your opponent with your eye. And then, as he goes to reply, you go like this. And if he can't reply, you make a gesture of triumph. And if he can get back at you, there's a special gesture with which he has to do this. And it's very, very animated and very dramatic and very, very interesting indeed, even if you don't quite follow the very abstruse debate. I must say that this sort of formalized or stylized debate on all these technical points of Vinaya and logic, these are very, very popular with the Gelugpas. They spend hours. And if you go, I'm told, to a monastery, you'll find very often under the trees in the courtyard groups of young monks practicing on one another like this. So that even if you're going around on some other business, someone may fire at you a question about logic or a question about the perfection of wisdom, and you're kept on your toes all the time. So this is the way in which they study, the way in which they learn. I should also incidentally mention that if you fail, and this happens very, very often, if you don't pass the yearly examination, you just carry on studying and you just try and take it next time. And you can take as long as you like. There's no fixed time limit that you must pass the course in so many years. If you're brilliant, you do it in 10 years. If you're just average, well, 12, 14, 15, 16. But in some cases, people who may not be so bright, or they may want to take their time, or they're not in a hurry, they may take 20 years, they may take 25, may take 30. No one minds. You just present yourself for the examination when you feel ready. And if you pass, well, you pass. And you go on to the next examination. This is the system, which seems a quite practical and quite sensible one. So this is how you become a geisha. So obviously you have to start rather young if you want to get anywhere at all by middle life.